Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I am your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa. Today we're going to be discussing a very important topic, Russia's resurgent influence or presence in Africa. I'm joined by a very special guest, Dr. Joseph Siegel. Dr. Siegel is the Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies at the National Defense University in Washington. Dr. Siegel has written extensively on Russia and Russia's relation in Africa, as well as other related issues of governance in advancing security and development, the role of external actors such as Russia, stabilizing fragile states, democratic transitions and strengthening institutions of democratic accountability, among many other things. Joseph, you've written extensively on this issue, and I'm very, very glad to have you join me today, and I look forward to our conversation.
Well, thank you very much, Michael. I appreciate the invitation and looking forward to the conversation as well.
Great, brilliant. So let's start off by, so we've definitely seen in the last couple of years, very recent years, Russia's growing influence or presence in Africa. What is the driving force behind this resurgent influence and presence in Africa?
Well, there are a couple of strategic drivers that are behind Russia's growing interest in Africa. First is, Russia's trying to establish some sort of enduring presence along the Mediterranean and the Red Sea. So it's a, geostrategic interest. It's part of why we're seeing the interest in Libya. Russia's trying to establish some naval bases in both Mediterranean and on Red Sea, Port Sudan primarily. And in that way, expanding its geostrategic presence, it puts itself in a position to interdict maritime traffic, and it poses a threat to NATO. So that's the first driver. The second is, Russia's trying to enhance its posture as a global power. Russia's, faced growing isolation following its invasion of Ukraine. It's under a lot of sanctions. And so to counter that, Russia wants to be seen as present and welcome across the globe. And Africa has provided a welcoming environment in a number of countries. The Russian foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, has made probably a dozen trips to Africa since the invasion of Ukraine. And so it gives the impression that Russia is welcome, that it is not affected by the sanctions, that it is not isolated. A third driver is, Russia sees Africa as a means to enhance its geostrategic interests by undermining the West. And so it has actively been promoting disinformation a lot in West Africa, but throughout the continent, blaming the West, especially France, for many of Africa's problems, blaming democracy, blaming the United Nations, and really trying to create a toxic atmosphere. All the while, Russia's not actually investing in Africa. So it's really just a posturing to diminish the influence of the West or the connections with the West, and in the process enhance Russia's influence. A fourth objective is that Russia's trying to undermine democracy on the continent. And we see this in some two dozen places where it's involved in electoral interference and promoting disinformation, helping prop up coup leaders or autocratic regimes. And by doing so, Russia, again, can gain more influence with those leaders. And it's also part of Russia's worldview, where the world is not based on some sort of normative framework supporting democracy, but that all governance systems, including autocratic systems, are equally tolerable. And that enhances Russia's interest and Russia's own governance system. So those are the main drivers of why we've seen this increase in Russian influence on the continent.
Let me take you up on that. So whilst these are very credible motivations, and so I've got several questions coming from your response. So but I want to go, is this opportunistic? So in terms of Russia undermining democracy or propping up junta governments or government and all of this stuff, is it one where Russia has deliberately initiated this, or has Russia just capitalized on the popular discontentment in these regions, in some of these countries? Has Russia taken advantage of, let's say, for instance, in Niger, where there's been a growing anti-French sentiment? Because in Niger, unlike some other places where it had coup, from my own research or from, you know, kind of the meetings I've been in, there's Russia hasn't played a very direct role in the coup, but they've taken, you know, they've taken advantage of the coup in that place. So can we say to some extent, Russia is taking advantage of this growing anti-Western narrative to then spread this disinformation? Have they been there from the start? Have they initiated it? I don't know if my question is very clear.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And it's a good example, because Niger had been making significant democratic progress over the past decade. They had had a successful transition of leaders. You had Mahmoud Bazoum in power. He had won his election, and people were actually generally content in Niger. And Niger had done relatively better economically. It was growing at a 7% growth rate. It was managing the security threats relative to what we saw in Mali and in Burkina Faso. And yet, you know, as we saw in Mali and Burkina Faso, there was a growing torrent of disinformation flowing in Niger about, you know, how democracy was failing, Bazoum was just a proxy for the West, that, you know, they needed to change, that there was this, you know, security threat. And that was building up for the whole year before the coup we saw in July of 2023. And, you know, I think we should keep in mind that coup did not come from the top of the military. That came from the head of the presidential guard, who was being removed, who was coming to his retirement, and Bazoum was going to replace him. And so he had an opportunity to seize power, and then, you know, he was able to build on this this narrative that had been promoted in large part from Russia to try to justify the coup. But, you know, all of the reasons offered in these coups that, well, the government was failing, it was corrupt, it was, you know, not doing a good job for security, other things, you couldn't really say that was the case in Niger. You know, Niger was doing relatively better under its democratic government. And so, you know, it's a case where, you know, Russia was actively involved. Yes, it was opportunistic, but it was opportunistic based on, you know, creating the, you know, playing up the grievances and fostering the polarizing narratives that helped create an atmosphere that was receptive to the military coup. Now we should also be clear, you know, it isn't clear that the people want that military government in Niger. You know, there wasn't a vote. As I said, there had been a vote previously for Bazoum. Since, you know, the junta has come in, they've closed off, you know, they've closed down the media space. People can't speak up. Opposition are being forced out of the country. And so it isn't, you know, those aren't the signs of a popular regime. And so in that sense, it's opportunistic on the part of Russia because they're able to prop up and support an unpopular regime. It helps Russia, but it hurts democracy and it hurts Niger's relations with international community. You know, 40% of foreign direct investment and development assistance for Niger is coming from the West. And so it really ends up hurting citizens in Niger as a result of that coup.
Before we come to the impact on the people of this information, we've also seen how in the wake of, you know, these coups and this resurgent military Wagner group and all of that, we've seen a kind of similar stuff we've seen in Afghanistan, where after 20 years of you know, the military and how Americans, you know, the US Western-led intervention retreated. And so we've kind of like seen that in, for instance, in Mali, you know, asking the UN mission to leave, and then in Niger as well, the French are now killing down or have left many of these places. And we're seeing why the French are withdrawing. So I guess the question is, how effective, from judging from these dynamics where it looks like there's a waning Western presence or Western influence in the region and then growing Russian. So this kind of geopolitical stuff, are we seeing some sort of Cold War level kind of politics going on here?
Well, there is clearly a geostrategic dynamic going on. And again, it isn't that France is withdrawing on its own. It's that there has been Russian-sponsored disinformation in Mali, Burkina Faso, Niger, that helped facilitate and foster these coups. Once the coups happened, that is when Russia gained influence. And then it's the juntas in those countries that have demanded that France leaves. And I should be clear, you know, the juntas have also disassociated themselves from the United Nations. They disassociated themselves from ECOWAS. You know, these things don't help when you're fighting an insurgency. You've had security partners. They're contributing resources. They've got troops on the ground. They're providing you know, other development and other support. And so who benefits when you push away all these security partners and when you're facing a threat? You know, it's not the people in those countries. They become less secure. They're worse off economically. So the real beneficiary is your geostrategic patron. That's Russia. So they're benefiting because they're pushing away the West. The junta's benefit because they have Russian support. But it's the people who are suffering from this geostrategic competition that is going on. And again, you know, Russia's not investing in these countries. You know, they're sending some of the Wagner forces now. They're called the AFRICOR. But you know, it's 1,000 troops here, 1,000 troops there. They're there to help keep those regimes, those juntas in place. They're not protecting civilians. And as part of those deals, they've signed arrangements to access gold primarily in Mali, and so they're extracting more resources than they're bringing into the country, and so there's this paradoxical narrative that it's good the West is leaving or France is leaving, we want the Russians, but you know, the Russians are the ones who are benefiting from these arrangements.
Very, very interesting. It's quite interesting that I had a retired brigadier general come on the podcast yesterday, and he was quite so. His perception or his view on the whole Russia thing was, this is no resurgence. Russia's always been there, and he's like, we've benefited from his as a military guy. He said we've benefited more or less from the West, and he was saying throughout the years, his Russian weapons that have been used to fight these insurgencies. It's Russian, you know, he's mentioning Russian aircraft, Russian this, Russian that. So I guess if the elites from that level sees, you know, more, and then he was looking at in terms of the West and how the West conditions and human rights and, you know, affects, you know, the fight or counter-terrorism funding or counter-terrorism support and how Russia, you know, there's the analysis he said. He said, fine, you know, we might not get the right quality that you get from the West, but at least you're getting what you want. So if you look at this and look at it in light of the ambivalent attitude, or ambivalent position of African government to the Russia-Ukraine war in taking a position, do you see any credibility in such perception or in such view?
I think this is a common perception of what we're hearing, but it's part of this distorted information environment that the Russians have helped to create. So I call it an asymmetric tool that Russia has used. You know, disinformation, they're able to push out a lot of these narratives about how helpful Russia is and how unhelpful the West has been, through social media, through bots, through different troll systems, through different influencers that they're paying in the region, and they're playing up grievances. You know, these are real grievances with colonialism, and of course, you know, colonialism is a legacy that's been there for decades, but in recent years it's been revitalized, and it's the Russians who are again poking at this very sensitive history that West Africa is facing. But and they're also playing up the security threat that we're seeing in Mali, Burkina Faso, and to some extent Niger. But interestingly, you know, since Wagner, the Russian mercenary group, became involved in Mali in 2021, the number of attacks in the Sahelian countries has doubled. The number of fatalities has tripled. So they're not actually helping on the security front. And as I mentioned, these juntas are distancing themselves from all of the other security partners, not just the Western partners, but the African partners, you know, ECOWAS and other neighboring countries who were trying to help. So there is this paradox where, you know, there's this sense, oh, Russia is so popular and helping us, but what's actually happening on the ground is the reverse. And when you look at it critically, who's benefiting? Well, you're the military juntas are benefiting, and the Russians are benefiting. But citizens are paying the cost in their lives with economics, worsening security, worsening ties within the region. And so it's, you know, it is, I think, very ironic that we hear this. You know, I think, you know, there are these narratives coming from military leaders who are supporting the juntas. This is touching on a bigger question for Africa, where you're seeing a resurgence of military governments. So we're seeing a throwback to the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, of course, which went very badly for Africa. And so, you know, and so there's another tension out there. There's another question that's being challenged about what the role of military should be in government. And I think that's part of what, when we hear those narratives from military officers about Russia, it's in many ways self-interested, because it's the Russians who are using the militaries to get more influence.
Brilliant. You've mentioned economics quite a number of times. So let's go to economics. So it does seem like it's one way. So we see in Libya, the Wagner group benefiting, you know, maybe oil in Libya, like you've mentioned, gold in Mali, Central African Republic as well, resources these places. And but in the light of the Russian-Ukraine war, where we begin to see some level of food insecurity, and then African governments now being forced to focus on maybe agriculture and all of that, does that have any? Would that influence the relation? Will Russia try to present itself as an economic partner? Does he really have the capacity? What is his level of, you know, economic relations with Africa historically at the moment?
Yeah, it's a great question, Michael. So it's another paradox that, you know, for many African countries, the priority is economics and development and jobs, getting resources. But Russia is not a provider of any of those things. Russia provides approximately 1% of the foreign direct investment coming into Africa. It's a very minor actor in that way. And with regards to trade, we've seen actually a decline in the level of Russia-Africa trade since 2019. It was about, you know, $19 billion then. It's about, you know, $14-15 billion now. So it's modest side trade, something like we would see with South Korea or Spain. And I should add, you know, most of that is of Russian products coming in rather than African products going out. It's about a 7-to-1 ratio of Russian imports into Africa versus Russian African exports to Russia. And so, you know, Russia isn't a big development partner. There's really a limited amount that Russia offers economically. You mentioned the agriculture, and so that is an area in terms of grain supply that has been important. Russia and Ukraine provide a sizable share of the grain, especially wheat, that comes into about a dozen African countries. You know, with the war on Ukraine, of course, those supplies were impacted. That caused food prices to skyrocket by about 20% in some African countries. This caused a lot of hardship. You know, after that, there was the Black Sea grain deal that was signed by the UN that allowed Ukrainian grain to be exported into global markets. And this helped reduce those global prices for about a year, until last year, when Russia pulled out of that grain deal. And in fact, they started bombing the Ukrainian ports that were exporting that grain. And so then we've seen a spike up in the prices of food prices and grain prices for the continent as well. Mm. Now, this was done right before the Russia-Africa summit last July in St. Petersburg. And so it infuriated a lot of African leaders and citizens. And it's one of the reasons that, you know, there were only, 14 or 15 different African leaders who showed up to that summit. And so I think there's a growing awareness on the continent that Russia isn't offering very much, certainly not economically. And so despite all the rhetoric, I think there's, many African leaders are keeping a distance from what Russia is doing, because it's in the end, it's not benefiting Africa. It's serving other interests that are out there.
So if we look at Africa's, if you look at Russia and then look at a more opposite or contrary approach by China. So look at how, whereas Russia positions itself as providing some kind of like security, or China itself is using a different approach. How does that? So I guess I'm asking this in the light of a new scramble of Africa, which I think you've also kind of like acknowledged in one of your pieces. So is there a new scramble for Africa? And these players, you know, we see more for China, we see is One Belt, One Road Belt initiative and, you know, economic approach. But do they all lead to the same exploitative tendency or exploit in Africa? Or does African leaders, African government have a leverage? What lever do they pull in all of these influences? Or do they not have agency? As we see, you know, like the 14 leaders you mentioned that showed up in Russia last year. So what leverage are they pulling? And how do you compare Russia's approach to China's approach? Do they eventually lead, even though it's kind of pull opposite, do they lead to the same, is it the same outcome?
Well, great set of questions, Michael. let me throw out a few observations. So first, I think how China is engaging the continent is different than how Russia is. I think China is bringing in real investment and it is engaging in trade. So there are real potential economic benefits in terms of that partnership. I think the question, though, does come down to your point about agency and whose agency is being represented in these deals. And even when we talk about African agency, which African agency are we talking about? And is it the leader's agency or is it citizens' agency? That's a big question, because a lot of the deals, even with China, they're opaque deals they're signing with leaders. And so my answer is the leverage is transparency. You know, the leverage is, if China is offering trade or investment, absolutely, that could be in Africa's interest. But let's look at the deal. Let's look at the details in the deal. Let's make sure it's transparent. Let's make sure it's signed off on by parliaments and citizens have a right to weigh in. And if it's, you know, if it's then serving African citizen interest, you know, that sounds great. That's a win-win situation. Unfortunately, sometimes, you know, when these deals are crafted in the back room, we don't know who benefits, and often they end up being elite bargains. So, you know, there are, you know, just those who are in power are capturing those benefits. The Chinese are benefiting from an extractive perspective. And And they can also be used as means of helping prop up these regimes that are not accountable to their citizens. And so in that sense, it has parallels to what we see with Russia. But it doesn't have to be that way. And there are cases where African citizens have undertaken strategic litigation and demanded transparency. They push back on some of these deals, and it's resulted in a better balanced arrangement. So, China has something to offer, but it really needs to be under scrutiny so that it benefits citizens. And I think that's this whole point about African agency and which African agency and the importance of citizen agency is just critical to that discussion.
In the meetings that I'm involved in, sometimes that one of the meetings was a dinner security meeting yesterday by Institute Montaigne. I don't know if you know, is a French one of the French leading staffers there. So the kind of feedback we get is that the West is not receding its influence. So, but the West is also listening to feedback and looking at ways in which, it can improve its relations, or look at where lessons that is learned from his engagement with Africa and how he can improve to better position itself in a way where its strategic interests is protected, as well as, his role in international. So how do you think, what are those lessons? What ways do you think the West, what could they have done better, and how can they, what can they do better? What can they change to be able to, retain or gain back, that level of influence they have?
Yeah, another great question. So first, I would challenge the premise that the West is in retreat. 90% of foreign direct investment, 90% of development assistance coming into Africa comes from the West. Outside of China trade, I think the top next nine trading partners on the continent are Western democracies. So the West has been engaged for a long time and continues to have interest in expanding partnerships in Africa. So I think that there's actually consistency there. The retreat, the so-called retreat, a lot of that is being manufactured again by primarily this Russian growing influence and distorting the information space. But I think in terms of receptivity, the West is continues to see Africa as a valued and important partner. Now, when we talk about the West, of course, there are many different countries in the West, and we have to be careful about generalizing, which it's easy to do in a conversation like this. But I think your question, what can the West do better? I think one of the things the West can do better is be more consistent about supporting good governance in Africa. That sometimes in the perception of self-interest, the West is inclined to just support some autocratic leader because he's friendly to a particular Western country, and that may provide some short-term influence. But as we know, autocratic governance is associated with, opaque deal making. It is involved with suppressing independent media, suppressing transparency. It usually, political monopoly leads to economic monopoly. So there are a whole host of problems when you don't have good governance. And so I think the West needs to recognize that its long-term interest and benefits overlap with African citizen long-term interest in terms of job creation, in terms of stable countries, in terms of rule of law, transparency. All of these things are going to contribute to a more productive, healthy, economic, social, political environment. That's how, you know, it's the long-term partnerships that are going to yield the most mutual benefits for both Africa and the West. And so that's what I would say the West, the collective West needs to do better with, is being consistent in supporting those elements of good governance and helping create strong foundations for citizen agency to deal with the challenges that African countries and communities face, but help create the huge opportunities that exist on the continent with the growing number of talented youth who have higher levels of education. Now, there's all sorts of economic potential on the continent, but it needs to have a stable rules-based, legal system that is going to support, merit-based activities, going to support fair competition, and promote private sector entrepreneurship and that sort of thing. That is going to be the dynamic. Those are going to be the dynamic drivers for African growth and development.
I can't agree with you more. This is what I've been advocating as well in some of the conclusions I've been making in my findings and writing that the Western focus on stabilization and stabilization driven intervention rather than looking at the long-term interest, long-term benefit, it's one that is not very useful. There needs to be a pragmatic shift. But I'm glad you mentioned what sometimes could be a paradox or could be, you use the word self-interest. So if I look at, so there are two questions I want to ask from here. If I look at it in the light of the Israel, Hamas or ongoing war, and how a lot of people have called into question, the West, reaction to the Russian-Ukraine war and its reaction to this. So that would be the first question. Would that fit into the kind of stuff you're talking about? Then the second question would be, you mentioned earlier in terms of one of the motivations for Russia, you said, is to have a control in the Mediterranean and Red Sea. So in the light of this same Israel-Hamas war, we've seen attacks on that sea routes, where from the Houthi attacks and all of that. But do we see Russian? I know Iran has been, fingered Iran and the Red, but we've not actually seen any accusations leveled against Russia when it comes to activities going around the Red Sea and the Houthi attacks. Or do you have any information regarding the role of Russia in that?
So yes, these are many complex issues to bring out there. I think the short answer is no. I'm not aware of any direct Russian involvement in the Houthi attacks on the maritime traffic. But as you're recognizing, there is a growing alliance between Iran and Russia. The Iranians are the primary supporters of the Houthis in Yemen. And so certainly from a proxy standpoint, the Houthis are serving Iranian influences in terms of trying to be disruptive. And that is part of a broader partnership with Russia. But I think, from an African standpoint, we want to be careful about not wrapping up African interests with what's going on in the Middle East, or even in Ukraine. those are really important global issues, and they're multi-layered, multi-sectoral, lots of dynamics involved. My concern is that they become a distraction for African interest, African priorities, African, getting more resources for Africa. And so it's easy for everybody to gravitate to these global crises that are in the news every day. But I don't want to subvert African interest to what is going on in these other places. And so I think it's important for African citizens and leaders to continue to advocate for African priorities and stay focused on what is most important. There's no shortage of issues, of course, that we need to give attention to on the continent.
I agree with you. Before I come to the last question, there's an interesting point you made in one of your pieces in terms of the impact of Russia's resurgent influence in Africa. You mentioned that it could disrupt or it could stoke or, a quest for or challenge the arbitrary colonial borders in Africa. And I find it very interesting because what we've seen, which is rather ironic, that in the last 60 years or so that Africans have gained independence, we've rarely seen interstate wars. Africans seem to have accepted, even though those borders are arbitrarily drawn, the Africans seem to have accepted and, somehow defend it in a way in terms of non-state interference and all of that. But you did mention one of the impact could be Russia could, raise or provoke such. I wanted to expand on that and see how that is possible.
Yeah, no, thanks, Michael. It's absolutely correct, and it's widely underappreciated that African leaders, citizens have been extraordinarily accommodating and gracious to work with the borders that they inherited and chose not to fight over these arbitrarily defined borders when there were plenty of reasons to dispute them. African diplomats, African citizens, recognizing that they shared some interests with people living across the border, took a more inclusive posture and tried to work with them and just saw that it would be, dysfunctional for all sides to be fighting over these borders and really embracing in some ways the notions of Pan-Africanism. And so we've avoided a lot of those interstate conflicts in Africa. And it's been a huge success that doesn't get the credit that it deserves. Now, the argument I'm making is, part of what Russia is doing in its invasion of Ukraine is it's challenging the UN principle about the respect for the territorial integrity of neighboring states and the respect for the sovereignty of states. Mm-hmm. So it's, potentially it's attempting to undermine that principle. This is why the Ukraine conflict is more important than just a fight between two neighboring countries. It's Russia's attempt to say the UN Charter doesn't really apply anymore. And it's part of Russia trying to reshape what a new world order would look like. We hear Putin, I should say, often say, we need to get rid of the current Western-based international order. what he's really saying is we need to get rid of the UN order. Mm-hmm. And that new order then would really be a reversion to the pre-United Nations order, where you had, you know, the idea that might makes right, that bigger countries can invade smaller countries and there's nothing the international community can do about it. It's very transactional. And so my concern is if that becomes the new norm, if that Russian order were to gain acceptance, if people were to tolerate, you know, Russia's invasion in Ukraine, then what's to stop that same logic from happening on the African continent? So bigger countries could swallow up smaller countries, or they could claim, well, that people group on the other side of the border, they should be part of our country. And so it opens up a plethora of potential challenges. It's a real Pandora's box of instability potentially on the continent if we throw out the principle of territorial integrity and respect for the sovereignty of other countries. And again, I think that would potentially threaten one of these great achievements that the continent has realized, you know, since independence and, you know, and since the creation of the UN system.
Lastly, to end on a positive note, irrespective of all of these challenges and Russian disinformation, Russian, you know, propping up authoritarian governments, we've seen that African citizens, either in the Afrobarometer, supports democracy. But what that democracy might mean, but democracy we believe is inherent to everyone. So African citizens seems to still uphold and want democracy, up to about a significant number, like 70%. So if you look at it more broadly to conclude, what do you think, how do you think this will play out? Or how is a way out? How do we respond to Russia's, to some greater level, dangerous, sometimes subtle aggression, or sometimes subtle strategic disruption of you know, maybe undermining democracy in Africa, propping up all of this? What is the better way to respond to it? And what's going to be, how do we respond to as international community? How does the African citizens or civil society respond to it? How do the governments? So I wanted to take you these different layers to conclude.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. Well, there's a lot of layers to it. and maybe we need another segment just to talk about this. It's a huge question and a really important one. And in the end, you know, what are Africa's interests? What are African citizens' interests? In the end, it's not about Russia. It's not about the West. It's what's about Africa, and what do Africans want? And as you say, Africans want democracy. And what isn't recognized is that there are efforts to undermine that democracy. You know, some of those are by opportunistic politicians, some are by military actors, but you have this role of external actors like Russia, and to some extent China, that are also trying to prop up authoritarian leaders. And they do that because it's easier to do. You know, authoritarian leaders, they're not accountable to anybody. So if you can form an alliance, if you can co-opt those leaders, then you can control them. And in a hierarchical system, you control the state. So it's a form of state capture. And it's easier to do than trying to gain influence in a democratic system where there's transparency, a free press, you know, exposing things, citizens talking about it. You have to build coalitions. You have to, you know, maintain support over time across different administrations. It's a lot more work to do that with a democracy. And so what we're seeing, you know, of course, we've been seeing democratic backsliding in the last decade, Part of that is being augmented by these external actors. And again, they're gaining from it. It helps enhance their influence, but it's to the detriment of African citizens. So how do African citizens combat that? And I think first is awareness, to be aware how democracy is being undermined in different places. And as I said, it's not one thing. There's lots of ways that democracy is being challenged on the continent. But you know, it's 30 years since the democratic wave first came to Africa. It's a new generation. People, you know, young people have to appreciate what democracy offers, and to advocate for it and defend it. Because what we see in any generation, and this is true for the West as well, if people don't remain engaged, there's always going to be somebody willing to come in and steal it. And so you have to defend your rights that have been so hard earned from previous generations. I think so it's important for citizens to be informed, made aware. Civil society, media need to be active. They need to talk about it. They need to defend their space. And in places where that space has been constrained and people can't talk openly, it's important for regional actors, the regional economic communities, the African Union, international, regional professional associations like lawyer societies and that sort of thing. They need to speak up and try to uphold these standards. One of the real setbacks we've seen on the continent is that these regional economic communities and the African Union have in their charters important principles about upholding democracy and the right of collective responsibility to maintain those principles. Yet we've seen support for that erode. And so if a leader, exceeds his two-term limit, or if there's a military coup, there's mild condemnation, but there isn't enough collective support to denounce that and maintain those norms. If a leader steals an election, it's tolerated. And so we're seeing a lowering of the bar of what's accepted in terms of governance and democracy on the continent. And so to push back on that, we need to see African citizens, governments, regional and interregional bodies speaking up and upholding those norms so that they can be maintained over time. And with that, then international democratic actors need to do more to support those very values and norms too. And so if you have people who are, fighting for free elections or media freedoms, the West needs to be backing them up as well. African agency requires African leadership at the starting point, as the foundation, and that provides a basis by which international democracies can come in and support. If the perception is that there's not African reformers, African Democrats out there, it's harder for the international democratic actors to see how they engage. There's a number of countries now because of the coups and term limit evasions where the governments are autocratic, and so they're not the ones who are going to be leading the charge for reform and a return of democracy. And so it is going to be important for civil society groups and others to speak up and do things, and we're seeing that and it exists, and it's always amazing to me how courageous and resilient you see African civil society leaders speaking up for these changes. And I think to defend democracy in Africa, we need to give give a higher platform to those voices, and more people need to come in and support them and back them up and not just tolerate these really frivolous claims that are allowing democratic principles to be subverted.
Wow, Joseph. Well, even though you did say this was complex layers, you've provided a very simplified, understandable, and credible responses to the challenges that Africa face. We're so grateful to, I'm blessed to have had you join us today, and we thank you for your very, very deep insights into the growing influence of Russia and external actors in Africa, and how Africa can stand up to such challenges with its partners. Thank you very much, just Dr. Siegel. I will keep in touch. Perhaps we could have another segment. I might take you up on that challenge and see how we can bring you back to talk about other areas of interest. But for now, we're grateful to have you.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Michael. My pleasure. I really enjoyed the conversation as well. Thanks for all the thoughtful exchanges, and be happy to join you again.
All right. Thank you very much. Have a great day. Thank you everyone for tuning in today. That was my conversation with Dr. Joseph Siegel. I hope you've gained a lot, as much as I've done today. And I encourage you to join us next week for another episode. Don't forget to subscribe to our channels. For now, have a great weekend, and I'll see you next week.